You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, taking you around the American League East for MLB.com Extras. Huge series in the AL East, Orioles and Red Sox, top two teams in the division, going head-to-head. So let's start with MLB.com Red Sox reporter Ian Brown. Ian, obviously a big series going on with the Baltimore Orioles right now. The Red Sox drop the opener, but then bounce back and win on Wednesday night. So that sets up a key game on Thursday. Let's go back through games one and two, though. First off, game one, David Price pitches well, doesn't get the win. It seems like we've said that kind of off and on throughout the season. And I think it kind of goes back to the home run ball because he keeps giving up those home runs. Has he talked much about what he has to do to stop? Because I think he gave up two hits on Monday, right? But or very few hits. But yeah, when he gives up the hits, yeah, they're leaving the park.
Just mistakes here, mistakes there. I mean, to tell you the truth, if a guy's giving up two or three runs in a start, I don't think that it matters if it's a home run or how he gives up the run. You know, you'll take that kind of performance. So it's just been isolated in the last couple starts. And I think the general story, though, is that David Price is very much getting himself back on track right now, and this is a very good sign. He's pitched well. I think it's seven times in a row since he hit that real low point at Yankee Stadium in early May. So it's funny. He was 7-1 when he wasn't pitching well, and now he's pitching great, and he's lost three straight starts. So it's just the way baseball works sometimes. But, yeah, no, David Price no longer a concern on this team, which is a good thing.
Yeah, the problem on Monday was Chris Tillman, who is back to 2014 Chris Tillman for the Orioles. He's really become an ace, and that team really needs him to be good because that's about all they have right now. But somehow they've been winning with that offense that we've seen. But then the Red Sox get a bounce back, and thanks to their stopper, I guess. You said David Price is getting into that groove, and he's been really good lately. Steven Wright, it's been all season long, second in the American League in ERA right now. And this feels like one of those, used to see this with Tim Wakefield every once in a while, right? He'd get on one of those rolls and locked in with the knuckler where it's really dancing. And these guys can be unhittable for stretches.
Yeah, even Tim Wakefield, really, he had a terrific career with the Red Sox. He won 200 games in his career. But the only time, he ever got in a stretch like this one that Wright is on right now, which is just not just a good pitcher, but an ace pitcher, is 1995 when he first joined the Red Sox. And that's kind of, how Wright is right now. Wakefield was 14-1 at one point that season. And, Wright is just going out there every single time and giving you innings. He's only giving up one or two runs. And it's just been amazing to watch. The one difference with Wright and Wakefield, Wright has a little more bite, a little more speed on the end of that knuckleball, so it makes it a little tougher. And even when hitters do time it right, they will be more apt to miss it or be a little behind it. So Wright's been, I think the best story on the Red Sox, one of the best stories of baseball, really, is you look at a guy who was just battling for a long relief spot in spring training. Nobody even expected him to be in the rotation. Your number five starter coming in becomes your best starter here in the middle of June.
Yeah, he has been unbelievable. And sticking with the rotation, Ian, Roenis Elias is going to make a start for the Red Sox. Obviously, he's the other guy that they got in that trade with the Mariners during the offseason. And they knew at some point they'd be calling upon him, and now is the time. What can we expect from Elias?
Yeah, I think Elias is a little determined here because he was surprised that he didn't make the team in spring training. He was the guy who started quite a few games for the Mariners the last 2 years. I think he thought he was going to make this team in some capacity, and it was kind of a humbling to him when he didn't. So he's pitched really well at AAA his last four or five starts now. So he wants to, facing Seattle, you're always a little motivated against the team that traded you. So it's kind of fitting that his first start comes against the Mariners here at Fenway on Friday. So it's going to be interesting to watch to see if he has a chance to decide, is this just going to be a one-start thing, or will he be in the rotation for more than one start? And I think that's what we find out starting on Friday.
And you would think with the need for a starter, the first name that would pop up would be sticking Clay Buchholz back in there. But instead they go with Elias. And Buchholz, I mean, he hasn't really been better since moving to the pen, right, Ian? I mean, he's given up three earned in six and a third innings. He hasn't really been in any big spots. How's he handling all this on a daily basis?
Yeah, I think it's tough for Clay. I mean, the guy's been a starter his whole life. Feels like a little bit of a you know, a fish out of water. And it's not like, as you mentioned, it's not like high leverage situations. So he's pitching in here. There was one time in Toronto where he came in extra innings there and got the win that day. And I think that was fun for him. But, you know, aside from that, just getting a feel for the routine, and they're still trying to keep him stretched out. So, you know, to me, the interesting thing is Clay Buchholz is inevitably going to get another crack to start. It's going to be, you know, how much this wake-up call, you know, motivates him to really pitch the way he's capable of. Will then, you know, the light click on for Clay, and then you start to see him get on one of those rolls. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a start really as early as next week because, look, Eduardo Rodriguez has not been impressive since he came back. Elias, you don't know how long he's going to be in the rotation. So Buchholz could get a chance here in the near future. And, you know, like I said, I'm really curious to see if he can kind of hit the ground running with that and sort of reclaim that spot in the rotation.
Hanley Ramirez hit a ball onto Lansdowne Street on Wednesday night. It really crushed one, and it had been a while. There was a drought there. Things were out of sorts. He had hit some home runs early in the season, but is he getting back into it? Is it clicking? And what has he talked at all about what the mechanical issue has been? Is there a reason for the struggles that he had been having?
Yeah, it was just a timing mechanism, really. He was a touch late. I don't think that he was seeing the ball particularly well either. Hitters just go into those funks sometimes, and I think you know what's happened. You saw him walk. He's walked in five straight games now. So when he's walking, that means that he's seeing the ball well. He's knowing which pitches to lay off, which pitches to swing at. So he, you know, he was noticeably confident after the game. He says that he's ready to get hot, and that would be a big boost for this you know Sox lineup because he can't expect Bogarts and Ortiz and some of these other guys to keep at the pace they've been at. So you need somebody else to sort of step up when one of those guys cools off, and Hanley thinks that could be him.
You mentioned Ortiz, who just doesn't seem like he's ever going to cool off, just continues to be on fire in his final season in the major leagues. And a neat milestone, I guess we could put it, he's joined now Carl Yastrzemski, Dwight Evans, Ted Williams, and Jim Rice as the only players to appear in at least 1,000 games at Fenway Park. That's pretty amazing for a guy that, when you think about when he came to the Red Sox, what his situation was, having been released by the Twins, being picked up off waivers, comes to the Red Sox, and now 1,000 games later at Fenway Park, it's remarkable.
Yeah, it really is. David has not only put up monster numbers since he's been here in Boston, but remarkably durable if you look at it. I mean, really, 2008, he had a wrist injury, which kept him out about a month and a half. 2012, he had an Achilles injury that knocked him out the second half of that year, but only because the team was out of contention. I think if they were in the race, they might have thrown caution to the wind there and got him back. So, yeah, just been you know, almost like Tom Brady with the Patriots. You know, another, you know, their careers have seemed to span each other's here in Boston and all the championships, but, you know, both of them just have just kept their bodies in shape and been able to just stay on the field and not let anybody else take that position from them.
Ian, Rosny Castillo's in the lineup on Thursday night. It's been a while since we kind of uttered those words, but what does he need to do here when he gets his chances in order to get more chances?
Yeah, he needs to hit the ball, Tim, and that's you know, he's a fine at defense. He's a pretty good left fielder, especially here at Fenway. If he can get on base, he can move around a little bit and give you a spark there, but just has not been able to elevate the baseball or hit for any extra base power. Really since the spring, because he really came into the year projected as the Red Sox starting left fielder, and then they saw his at-bats, and not that you go by spring training stats, but that what they were going by was that he had just become a ground ball machine. He was no longer elevating anything. And even at Pawtucket this year when he's having success, mostly ground ball singles. So he needs to start driving the ball again. And if he can do that, then maybe he can factor into a more prominent role in the team here.
Brittany, big series this week in the American League East. Orioles and Red Sox, they come into the series tied for first place, but the Orioles able to take game one on Tuesday night. They win it 3-2, so they take sole possession of first place heading into Wednesday night. Big reason for the win, Chris Tillman outdueling David Price, and Tillman, he's been so good. He continues to be the ace of the staff. And really, if you look at the whole season, he's really been a better pitcher than David Price has been. Now 9-1, the 2.87 ERA. He was very good, seven innings on Tuesday night. And a stat that I saw that stood out to me, the Orioles without Tillman on the hill, 25-24. Where would they be without Chris Tillman being Chris Tillman this season?
Oh, wow. I didn't know some of those stats. Yeah, that pretty much says it right there. They would definitely be struggling. I think when you look at Chris Tillman, their opening day guy, really didn't have a great season last year. Really didn't have a great spring training, but he's been what they need, and that's been huge. Really, the tale of this whole team has been, can they pitch? And they've really struggled with that as of late. Having a stopper like Chris Tillman, having a guy go out there, take the ball every fifth day, know that most of the time he's going to post up, and his ERA is now under 3, has been huge for the Orioles. I don't know where they would be without him. It seems like even like yesterday, when he's not doing that great the first few innings, he finds a way to settle in and give him 7 strong innings. So he's been huge.
Yeah, and he was on the ropes a couple times early, and being able to escape jams like that at Fenway Park is no easy task.
Yes, I would agree. I couldn't believe it was 2-0 still in the 6th inning. I looked up, like, how is this game still 2-0? And that's just Chris Tillman making pitches, finding a way to get the job done despite not being dominant early.
So he's been great early, and maybe the only Orioles pitcher that's been great early, but Zach Britton's been there all season down the stretch as far as closing games out, and now with Vance Worley hurt and Darren O'Day hurt, Britton asked to give even more, I guess, and it's a 5-out save on Tuesday. Obviously, you can't ask that from your closer all the time, but in a big game on the road against a division opponent, Buck goes to Britton in the 8th, and man, he continues to just do anything that's asked of him.
Oh, God, he's good. Tillman said yesterday that he's incredible, and not just because he's his teammate. He thinks it's probably some of the best stuff he's ever seen. You watch that sinker, and you just wonder how people are able to have a good at-bat off of that, how they're able to hit the ball very hard. And, you know, most of the time they don't. And Britton's been nothing short of dominant pretty much from the day he was moved into that closer role. So, I really, you know, we talked about where would the Orioles be without Chris Tillman. Where would they be without Zach Britton, especially without Darren O'Day right now? You kind of shudder to think of where this team would be and how big their struggles would be without Zach Britton.
Wednesday night, it'll be Kevin Gausman on the hill for the Orioles. And Brittany, I know Gausman, he's been inconsistent. He hasn't been great all season, but I was just looking at the number, and I can't believe he hasn't won a game yet this season. Does that surprise you? I mean, I feel like he's pitched good enough, and we talk about the value of the stat, the win, but this guy hasn't won. Are you surprised at all that he hasn't been able to at least get a notch in that win column?
Yes, very. Maybe it'll be tonight. Who knows? But, yeah, I agree with you. He's pitched well enough a few times, and just such a fluky, weird stat, and this is another good example of why it's not a stat that should have as much value as people try to place on it.
Yeah, certainly. And obviously that's a growing sentiment across baseball. The other shakeup or the shakeup as far as the starting rotation goes is Giovanni Gallardo finally healthy. At one point, maybe there was a question who would he replace in that rotation, but Ubaldo Jimenez kind of answered that question for everybody with the way he's been pitching all season and especially lately. And I think the exclamation point over the weekend when he only goes a third of an inning, basically, statistically, he's maybe the worst starter in baseball so far this season. Such a huge disappointment. Is there any hope this season for Ubaldo Jimenez to find his way back, to figure it out in the bullpen, and to contribute to this team?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Orioles hope there is. Ubaldo hope there is. We just talked to him about half an hour ago, I guess, but he seemed disappointed. He's such a good, nice guy, and I think that gets lost in all this because he hasn't been a good pitcher. But it's been pretty clear. He hasn't been able to get the job done, as you mentioned. Getting one out in Toronto was really the final straw, just the way he's been crushing the bullpen. And you can't, as a team that's trying to contend, have a guy who's going to go out every 5 days and do that to your team, to the morale, to the bullpen. Really set you up for a few days to struggle. So this was the thing they had to do in 2014 as well. And he went to the bullpen. He pitched okay, but it's also tough. And I don't think people realize is that when you put a guy in the bullpen, he's still going to pitch. So he's got to figure it out. He's got to figure out a way to get some of these guys out. And they are lucky that Giovanni Gallardo is healthy, his back is coming into the rotation, but they still don't have a whole lot of depth. So something tells me we haven't seen the last of Ubaldo Jimenez making a start for for the Orioles this season.
And I know it's easy to think, oh, thank goodness, here comes Gallardo. He's going to, you know, this is the guy they got in the offseason, obviously, spend money on. He's going to kind of help right the ship. But if you look at how he pitched before getting injured, it wasn't really good. I mean, he made four starts early in the year, 18 total innings, the ERA at 7. Is there reason to believe coming off the injury he's going to be better than he was those first four starts?
Yes, because Gallardo kind of admitted that he never really felt that good. He never felt right. And I think part of it is signing late. He didn't really get that spring training. And, you know, he did feel something in that arm that last outing before he went on the DL. But his velocity wasn't good before that. Now it's back up. So they feel like maybe he's never quite 100%. And that's really what they're hoping now, that he's going to be different than he was before that injury. That's something that was kind of nagging, maybe hampering him. It didn't really rear its head fully until that last start. But I feel like Yovani looks crisper. He looks much more like the Yovani Gallardo that they thought they had signed this winter.
They let him seem like really take his time through the rehab process. Was that part of it all, that not only was he rehabbing, but maybe it was helping to give him almost like an extra spring training or a redo with spring training?
Right. That was part of it. And that was part of why they decided to go with that third rehab start, I think, too. Keep in mind, he's never had an arm injury where he's had to be on a major league disabled list. So it's a little bit of uncharted territory here for Gallardo. Now he's back. They gave Yovaldo Jimenez as long of a leash as they could. So when you look at all those things, they're all reasons why they felt the need for him to make that third start. And they're pretty confident now that he's going to come back, and there's not going to be any babying him. The other team's going to dictate how deep he goes in the game.
Brian, this is supposed to be the point in the season where the Yankees go on a roll, right? Colorado, Minnesota. 11 straight games versus two teams that on paper the Yankees should take care of, but not a good start as they drop two out at Coors Field, and that's baseball, but you can't overlook anybody, and you definitely can't overlook the Rockies in Coors.
No, but that's the reason that Joe Girardi was so testy in the manager's office yesterday at Coors Field, is that they knew this was a soft spot on the schedule. People had been talking about it, made them very aware of that. And no, you can't just throw your gloves out there and expect to win a game. But they really didn't pitch in Denver very much. I know the first game was 13-10, but it really wasn't that close. You know, they scored 7 runs in the 8th inning. That was a 12-3 game, so you can't be shocked that they lost that one. And then really there wasn't a whole lot of life in the second game either. Ivan Nova didn't pitch great. They threw out a lineup that had Chase Headley batting 4th. You got Didi Gregorius batting 5th. It reminds you how vulnerable this team could be when they're in National League Park. So you don't have Carlos Beltran out there in right field. He should be back there tonight against the Twins, but you didn't have Alex Rodriguez. He should be back as well. But, yeah, I hate to say it's getting late early, but it is. You look at the calendar here, and if they're not going to go on a run now, I'm not sure when they are.
You mentioned Beltran. Now, would they have had Beltran had they been in American League ballpark? Because I guess the knee swells up of all times on an off day for Beltran. But is he feeling better?
Really bizarre, yeah. He said he didn't do anything that off day in Colorado. He just kind of walked around and went about 5 blocks, got some lunch, and then all of a sudden it swelled up in the morning. But I think that had they been in an American League ballpark, he might have been able to DH. He probably wouldn't have been out there in the outfield. And you know, I was kind of laughing. That is a big right field in Coors Field. So that's a lot to ask Carlos Beltran, even if he's 100%, to go patrol at this stage of his career. So defensively, they're probably better with Aaron Hicks out there anyway. But this is what you got when you get a veteran team here that in their late 30s, you're going to have these creaks and aches and pains. And, you know, I think that's just going to be the way it goes for the rest of the year. And the trainer's room will have a pretty well-worn path in the carpet going in and out.
As someone who's gone for a short walk and been sore afterwards, I would say it's not an injury as much as it is old age for Beltran. But yeah,
I've done that too.
Speaking of the older Yankees and injuries, Mark Teixeira getting closer to rehab, slowly making his way back as he's not going to surgery. How far away is Teixeira?
I was very surprised. You know, Teixeira is very encouraged. He was jogging a little bit in Denver. And I thought that when they said 3 weeks, I'm thinking in my mind, all right, that's probably going to be more like 5 or 6, right? But he says everything's been going great. He's responding to the cortisone shot, the lubricant. And so he's really shooting toward playing in minor league rehab games next week. So I think that absolute best case scenario, and this is if everything goes perfectly and there are no setbacks, he could be back in the Yankee lineup next Friday in New York. Don't be surprised if it takes a little bit longer than that, if they're a little more cautious. You know the Yankees' track record with that. But looking at the performance they've got out of first base this year, and I know that Teixeira is a big part of that, they are the league's worst in batting average, slugging percentage at first base. And so who knows if Ike Davis and Rob Refsnyder can be the answer there, but they really do need Mark Teixeira to come back and be the Mark Teixeira who last year was an all-star. Let's not forget, it's not like he's 5 years removed from that. He was able to do it last year, and you wouldn't think that a leg fracture would set him back that much. I really do believe he can come back and be more like the guy from last year, even though I think that 30 homers and 100 RBIs are pretty much off the table at this point.
First base in the city of New York this season is, I don't know what's going on, Brian, but Teixeira, all the injuries, Chris Parmalee injured now. And then you look at the Mets side of things, and Duda is out for a while. They can't find anyone to get in there at first base and fill the role. And so the Yankees have come to the point now where they've gone out and gotten a former Met. I don't know if that's going to help. But, I mean, Ike Davis seems like a guy that I don't know what's really left in the tank. Obviously, after he's left the Mets, he's bounced around a few times. He was in Pittsburgh. He's been around different places. I mean, what do the Yankees really realistically think they can get from Ike?
I don't know what he's got left in the tank either, but you got to throw somebody out there.
Yeah.
So they wanted somebody who could play the position and has done it. Parmalee was kind of that guy, and now you've got him down, so you fall even another one down on the depth chart. And really, it's just anybody but Nick Swisher. Anybody, please, but Nick Swisher is basically what you're hearing out of the Bronx. And so they're going to give Ike Davis a shot. And, you know, with that left-handed stroke, I'll be interested to see what happens in Yankee Stadium. I feel like on this podcast for the last year or so, we were talking about how Dustin Ackley was supposed to be this guy. And the Yankees analytics people said that if you put him in Yankee Stadium, he's going to produce. And obviously that didn't turn out to be the case. So maybe that's the case with Ike Davis. It's somebody that the Yankees had interest in over the offseason. He signed with the Rangers over the Yankees, but wound up in pinstripes. And obviously he's following in the footsteps of his father, who pitched for the Yankees in the late 70s and early 80s. And one interesting fact here, there have only been two father and son duos to play for the Yankees. The other one, Yogi Berra and Dale Berra. Pretty good company there.
The Rays suddenly turning things around a little bit. They had lost 10 of 12, but then suddenly over the last couple of weeks, they've actually won 8 of 10. They've gotten things going. They continue to hit home runs. But other than that, what's been the big change here over these last couple of weeks with the Rays?
Well, for starters, I think the starters are going a little bit deeper in the game and getting a little closer to what everybody thought they were going to be. I think that's probably the biggest thing. Other than that, you know, I think the consistent hitting, you know, is really showing up. You know, the guys like Pierce, and of course you got Morrison's been playing pretty well, hitting a lot better than he did at the beginning, and then Evan Longoria has been red hot.
Yeah, talk about Longoria, because man, this is like vintage Evan Longoria. Last 15 games, 22 of 58. And in that stretch, he's got 8 homers and 20 RBIs. I mean, we haven't seen that kind of power in a stretch for Longoria in a while.
Yeah, I talked to him about his hitting about a week or so ago, and he told me he had made some changes. He'd opened up a little bit, and he said it was hard to, you know, tell himself he needed to make the change. But ever since he's done it, he said he's felt really locked in. And this is maybe about a month and a half ago he did this. So you look back and you look at the numbers since then, and they've been pretty darn good. And, of course, a side note about Longoria, tonight he will tie Carl Crawford for the longest tenured Ray. So big game.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And he's certainly, I would say, Mr. Ray, if there is one. It's been Evan Longoria since being drafted by the team, being brought up, and then early on really committing to staying in Tampa Bay. So they're playing Seattle right now, and they're going to take on Nathan Carnes. So I think, Bill, it's a chance to kind of revisit the trade from the offseason. Carnes went to the Mariners. Logan Morrison, Brad Miller come to Tampa Bay. Carnes, a 5-2 for Seattle. He's been helped by a pretty good offense as far as the Mariners go. Speaking of teams that hit a lot of home runs, they've done that. His ERA is over 4. If you had to grade that trade right now, do you have to give the edge a little bit to the Mariners with what Carnes has done as opposed to Brad Miller and Logan Morrison starts with the Rays?
I don't know. I'd say it's more like a wash.
Okay.
I really liked Carnes, too, and talking to him yesterday, you know, he was happy to be back, and, you know, he really appreciated his time in Tampa, and, you know, he said he's pitching, he's feeling well and looking forward to pitching against them tonight, but, you know, Miller's been, the only thing Miller's been is, it hasn't been a positive, I think, has been just a little bit of his fielding. And, of course, Morrison has come on and kind of silenced his critics, whether he can keep that up or not. So maybe a slight edge to the Mariners.
Yeah, and it's obviously early. I mean, if I'd asked you that question a month ago, the way Logan Morrison was hitting, it might have been different. And who knows by the end of the season where we think about the trade. So it'll be Carnes against Drew Smyly. And Smyly skipped in his last start, not because of an injury or anything like that, I guess just to give him a little time, and he had been struggling. What were his thoughts on getting the extra days off? I know they had done the same thing for Odorizzi a little bit ago, and it's a good thing to do with starting pitchers throughout the year, give him a little break here and there. But what's his viewpoint on it? Did he appreciate the rest? Would he have rather been out there?
Well, they're always going to say they'd rather be out there, but I think he probably felt good getting a little bit of it because he was struggling as I think he felt good getting a little bit of the extra time because he's been struggling with his, you know, secondary pitches. And not that they haven't had the action he's wanted. He's just had a hard time putting them where he wants to, you know, put them. And, you know, that shows, I think he's given up 7 home runs in his last 4 starts. And that's unlike him. Unfortunately for him, you know, I thought if, you know, in our conversations, you know, from our conversations that I thought he was the best pitcher on the staff for the early part of the season, and, you know, he really didn't get much to show for it because, you know, just kind of the way the team was scuffling, so the numbers don't reflect it as much as I think as well as he pitched, but, you know, and then he's then come into May, later May and into June, he's been struggling a little bit, so I look for him to bounce back. He's a good pitcher, and I think the time off is only going to help him.
The Rays also make another move, and I think a move people have been kind of anticipating and waiting for and wondering when it would happen. But Blake Snell is going to make a start on Thursday. Obviously, he's the guy that got off to such the amazing start, really, in the minor leagues a year ago. His numbers this year, I mean, they are what they are. 3-5. The ERA is pretty good, 3.29. 12 starts at the AAA level. I think he'd already kind of proven that he had done what he could do at that level. I don't know if that goes into it all, but what's the expectation for Blake Snell making his second major league start on Thursday?
Oh, I think the expectation's the moon. But,
yeah.
You know, I know myself, I had a little bit of a hard time understanding sending Andrees to the bullpen as good as he's been. But, you know, I think they said they needed some help in the bullpen. And Andrees, of all the starters, was the only one who's really spent any time there. So he was the odd man out, and they're bringing up Snell. So I didn't get to see him pitch in person the first time up. I did watch on TV, and he looks like he's got all the poise and all the pitches. So I would expect to see another outing like that tomorrow.
Yeah, April 23rd was that debut. It was against the Yankees. He got a no decision. 5 innings, he allowed just 2 hits and an earned run. He struck out 6, so he was very good. Like I said, the numbers in AAA haven't been great, but a lot of things can go into that, especially when a guy maybe thinks he should be pitching in the major leagues. But we'll see what he can do. It's certainly exciting for fans because this is a guy that people have been anticipating for about a year now. You mentioned Andrees, and he certainly is the odd man out here. He's been pitching very good since getting called up. How has he taken the move to the bullpen?
Well, I mean, I thought he gave a pretty honest answer when he said he had mixed emotions. That's about as honest as it gets. You know, it's kind of, you know, to me, and this is just me speaking, it's not the Rays. I just, you know, I think it sends the wrong message when you have a guy who's getting the results and he's the one who gets sent to the bullpen. But, you know, they've got their way, they figure, of doing things. So, That's what happened.
Gregor, after a loss to the Phils on Monday night in this odd home-and-home series with Philadelphia, the Blue Jays have bounced back. They won on Tuesday. They won on Wednesday. And playing good baseball right now. How did this home-and-home come about? Because I know these are usually the rivalry setups in baseball where you do the two home games, then the two road games. But Philadelphia and Toronto interleague doesn't really feel like that.
No, it doesn't. And the Jays have kind of switched teams over the course of this interleague time. I mean, their natural rival for a little bit was Atlanta, and then it became Philadelphia. I mean, ever since Montreal left Major League Baseball, there wasn't really that kind of natural rival for the Jays. And so, I think they've kind of experimented with a few things. I think most recently, the reason why there was a bit of a compelling angle was because of well, it goes back to the 93 World Series, but after that, more recently, Roy Halladay going to the Jays, I think there was a lot of, or going from the Jays to Philadelphia, I think there was a lot of interest there. That allowed Halladay to come back and do that. But yeah, these two teams, I think calling them rivals would certainly be a bit of a stretch, but it certainly is an interesting home and away series, that's for sure.
I'll buy the World Series and the Halladay thing, and there's hope that someday there'll be baseball in Montreal again, and the Blue Jays will have that natural rivalry. So I know they're playing good baseball. I hate to start on the negative, but I'm going to go to R.A. Dickey losing on Monday at home and the fact that he's winless at home this season, 0-5. Is there anything to that? Has that always been a thing with Dickey at Rogers Center, or is it just getting him this year?
I think it's getting him this year a little bit more than others. Some of those numbers are a little bit slightly skewed because he did have a lot of home starts early on in the year, and he is a notoriously slow starter, at least since he came over to the Blue Jays. It seems like, his April and May, each of the last 3 years has been pretty disappointing. But one thing he's been able to do pretty much every time is turn things around. And I think he's actually looked pretty good now for a little bit of a while. There's a little bit of bad luck involved in there. But the one thing that, we can certainly now get rid of is, when R.A. Dickey first came to the Blue Jays, there's so much talk about how the dome could be a real benefit for him. And, a lot of those early season starts come with the dome closed. And so the dome hasn't really played up quite the way that I think the team and probably even Dickey himself expected. I think the fact that the ball carries so well in that ballpark, this is a guy who's given up more home runs than anyone in baseball since the start of 2013, and I think Rogers Center has played a bit of a role in that. But I expect him to do what he's done the last few years as well, and I think he's kind of already started to do that, and I think he'll probably go on to have a relatively strong second half like he's known to do.
It came out, or it kind of became official from Gibbons this week, that Aaron Sanchez is eventually at some point this season going to make that move to the bullpen. Is that something that you kind of expected all year, or did you think he'd hang in that rotation? And is there any thought on a time frame of how this will go about?
Yeah, well, it was the plan that was stated in spring training. But when the Jays, initially made that announcement, I don't think anyone thought that Aaron Sanchez was going to be quite this good. I mean, he has been dominant for most of the season. He's been one of the better starting pitchers in the American League. And so, the plan all along was to have him on this innings limit and move him to the bullpen in the second half. I think the reason why it's getting some attention now is because we're getting a little bit closer to that time, and Sanchez is just pitching so well. But a lot of people were wondering whether the Jays were going to change course and try to do a situation, like the Mets did with Matt Harvey, where they try to get him through to the end of the year and potentially into the postseason. But this seems to be a little bit more like what Washington did a few years ago with Steven Strasburg. I don't think there's, Gibbons in his comments yesterday, they were his strongest comments yet. Didn't really leave any kind of wiggle room for the possibility of Sanchez staying in the rotation. He said multiple times it's going to happen. He's going to the bullpen. So it seems like the club is very adamant about that, and I don't think they're going to change. So I think the situation is you're going to see Sanchez probably move to the bullpen right around the trade deadline or maybe after the All-Star break, somewhere in that mid-July to late July run, and that's going to allow him to then move into the bullpen. And it's going to be a blow to the rotation, no question about it. The one benefit is that it will help that bullpen a lot, and it's an area on the team more than any other right now that does need some help down there, because it's one spot that the Jays really haven't quite figured out quite yet.
Right now, there's no obvious person to take that spot, though, in the rotation either. Is that something where they trade for somebody, or do you see somebody in line for that?
I think it's going to be Drew Hutchison.
Okay.
You know, he's pitching pretty well down in AAA right now for Buffalo. Obviously, he had a very disappointing season last year. You know, goes from opening day starter to a guy who didn't really have a rotation spot in the second half as well. And you know, I wasn't surprised by any means that he didn't win a rotation spot this spring, but he's bounced back pretty nicely. But it's one thing to do it in AAA, and it's another thing entirely to do it in the major league. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Jays do explore the trade market as well at some point in time, but this is not going to be a situation from 2015. I mean, the market for starting pitchers seems to be like it's going to be pretty limited anyways, but even if there was a surprise big name that goes on the market, I don't think that's what the Jays would be you know, looking for. I think you're talking about more like a number four, number five guy to kind of round out the rotation. And internally speaking, I think Drew Hutchison can be that guy. He doesn't need to come in and be a frontline guy by any means. They just need someone who can give them some reliable innings. It'll probably be him, but the depth is an issue. So if someone gets hurt over the next few weeks, suddenly that changes everything, because after Drew Hutchison, there's not really a whole lot down in Buffalo. Wade LeBlanc's having a nice season, but I don't know how much they expect out of him. They don't have a lot of depth to work with, so not only do they need to replace Sanchez, but they need to protect themselves long-term as well in case someone gets hurt.
Yeah, and even if they wanted to go out and get a big pitcher at the deadline, if there was one available, I don't know if the Blue Jays really have the resources in the minors, prospects to trade away this time around, because they traded a lot of them this year. That brings us to the draft a little bit, Gregor, as they try to replenish that system. And when you look at what Toronto did in the draft, they went heavy on college players, heavy on position players, which I think makes sense, because your college players are going to come quicker. You're going to get them to the higher levels of the minor leagues quicker. And that's what they did early on. They get TJ Zoik, a right-handed pitcher out of Pitt, with their first-round pick. Then they go an outfielder from the college ranks, J.B. Woodman of Ole Miss. I like the pick at number 66, Bo Bichette, obviously the bloodlines with Dante Bichette. And he's reached an agreement, right? Is that, did that just happen today?
Yes, that's, well, it was reported a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Jim Callis was one of the first guys to have that, and he got a bit of an overslot deal to sign in. And I'm with you. I like that pick a lot as well. You know, that's the one that seems to be, it's a riskier pick than the others. It seems like the Jays did kind of play it safe. And I think the reason why was because of what you touched on. You can bring in some college guys into the system that can flood the upper levels of the minor leagues a little bit quicker. You know, the Jays did completely kind of decimate their minor league system over the last few years, but they do have some interesting prospects down in like single A, and that's going to take some time, but now they can move some of these other guys that they got this year along a little bit quicker to maybe provide themselves with a little bit more of a well-rounded you know, draft or minor league system. But Bichette is one of those guys who is a bit of a riskier guy, but I think they really like the upside. They really like the power. He's got some very interesting mechanics at the plate. It remains to be seen whether or not that's going to still allow him to find success as he continues to go on. It's a very unique style. He's got a lot of moving parts there. But the power is something to behold. And, you know, he's a guy who actually worked out with the Blue Jays because he's got a pre-existing relationship with Troy Tulowitzki because of his father was a coach in the Rockies system when Tulo was around. And so those two guys have a bit of a relationship. And Bichette actually hit with some of the Blue Jays this offseason. And Tulowitzki's obviously not around right now because he's hurt, but Kevin Pillar was part of that batting practice session, and I was just talking to him earlier this week about what he thought about Bichette, and he had nothing but good things to say about the guy, and he was saying that Bichette was hitting the ball farther than most of the other Blue Jays who were there, whether it was Ryan Gomes, Chris Colabello. There's a whole lot of guys down there that were working out with Bichette, and it seems like he put on quite a show. So the potential is there, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to take him some time as a high school guy. He's going to be brought along slowly, but it's a very enticing pick.